You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo here across Australia on the Community Radio Network. This Allegro is the third show looking towards Anzac Day. The actual history of Anzac Day is not what we are about. We are looking at the personal stories behind the issues on different levels. 2 weeks ago, we heard from Dr. Ivan Holmes about his experiences in Papua New Guinea fighting the Japanese in 1943.
Last week we heard the stories of men who flew warplanes in World War II as chronicled by author Michael Veitch in his books Flak and Fly.
This week we will look more closely at the experiences of gays and lesbians in the military.
Until 1992, the Australian Defence Force retained the right to dismiss homosexuals from its ranks.
Since then, it seems that although they could not legally discriminate, they could make it intolerable for gay men and lesbians to be in the military. There are mixed opinions on how it is now, so today on Allegro, we'll ask someone from the ADF about this.
We heard from Lee Visser in the first hour of Allegro about what it was like for him in the army and serving in Vietnam. Although he was aware of his sexuality, he didn't disclose or identify for fear of receiving a dishonourable discharge.
Same-sex partner entitlements came into being in 2005 in the ADF. The extension of these benefits comes 13 years after the removal of the Australian government's ban on gays and lesbians serving in Australia's military.
Can homosexuals serve openly in the Australian Defence Force today? Is it acceptable or is it politically correct lip service? How acceptable by the ranks and file is it really? Do they serve openly in the Australian Defence Force? What about the people who suffered dishonourable discharges? Do they have any regress or has there been likely to be an apology?
Joining us on the show today, we have two very special guests, and I'd like to say a special thank you to Defglis, which we'll talk about later. We have with us leading seaman Troy Malcolm. G'day, Troy.
Hi, how are you today?
And we have Major Damien Hadfield joining us on the phone. Hello, Major Hadfield.
G'day, Adam.
Right. Now, we wanted to talk a little bit about this topic because it's fascinating, and it's something that we don't have much access to in the wider community. It's almost like a movie sort of theme, looking at gays, homosexuals in the military. And I guess you're both here to say, yes, there are gay and lesbian people in the military. Major Hadfield?
Yes, there are gay and lesbian people in the military, and I am one of them.
And leading seaman, Troy?
Yes, absolutely. There's lots and lots of gay and lesbian people.
Okay. But the big question is, how open and honest and how much can they be gay and lesbian? Or is it a bit like... I'm at work in a Catholic school, okay? So while most people know I'm gay, we don't talk about it. What's it like for gays? Perhaps, Major Hadfield, you can tell us a little bit about what it's like for gay people and how acceptable is it for gay people in the ADF?
Okay, Troy, look, in my experience, it's never been an issue for me. I'm openly gay. I don't, you know, it's not the first thing I say to everybody that I meet. But I certainly don't hide it, and I've never had any concerns with it in that regard.
Major Hadfield, were you openly gay before you went up through the ranks? I mean, it wasn't an inhibition for you?
Well, I'll tell you a bit about my background, if you like. Back in 1992, when the laws were changed, I was heavily, I'd say, ensconced in the gay community in Melbourne. I was the convener of the Melbourne Uni Gay Society. I was a volunteer with the Victorian AIDS Council's Youth Projects team. I was a counsellor and also working at the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard Telephone Counselling Service.
I believe you were also involved in radio.
I was. I was a presenter on Joy Melbourne.
You were indeed.
Mirrorballs and Lip Gloss.
I remember
it
well.
And BGs.
Yes. I remember that.
So look, you know, and I was quite comfortable in my little gay world. And then I remember at Melbourne University, there was a debate on being hosted by the Liberal Club about whether or not the policy should be changed to allow gays and lesbians to serve openly in the ADF. And I went along as convener of the Gay Society, and it was an open debate, and I got up and I said, look, you know, I don't have any desire, really, to join the military, but God damn it, I should be allowed to if I want to. And then, lo and behold, 2 years later, I did. I did actually join, but it was more for the job. The job actually attracted me, not the defence itself.
Okay, could we just ask leading seaman Troy Malcolm about you when you joined? Did you know you were homosexual when you joined?
At that stage, no, I didn't. I joined at a very young age, at 17, and that's going back in 1984, so I've seen some significant changes since then. It probably wasn't until I was in my early 20s,
yeah.
I guess so, and that was just prior to 92, obviously prior to 92, when they lifted the ban of gay and lesbian okay. service members. So,
how did you feel when you discovered you were gay and that you were in the, when you were in the Navy?
At that time, I was actually serving in the Air Force. I did a okay. service transfer over to the Navy at a later stage. But, it was difficult, I guess, in some... I certainly couldn't come out at that stage because, I guess, society was still okay. a little bit different then as well.
Major Hadfield, do you have it... And have you had to work with people who've been traumatised in any way or had difficulty accepting their sexuality while they've been in the ADF?
Yes, I have, but I would say, Troy, that I see
Adam.
The military as a... Adam. I see the military as a bit of a microcosm, I guess, of the rest of society. And I'd say, yeah, people going through that coming out sort of phase, whether they're in the military or in any occupation, can find that a difficult experience. Now, in some ways, perhaps being in the military may make it more difficult in their mind, but also it might make it more easy if you're away from your family and mm-hmm. your friends. It might make it easier for you to experiment as well.
Major Hadfield, are there a significant or a number of homosexuals serving in the Australian Defence Force?
Well, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but I think there's a lot, and a lot that aren't as open, say, as I am, mm-hmm. or other members of DEFGLIS are. But yes, I'd say there's... quite a few, and it's not only when you think about the army, say, which is my service, you think about infantry, and yes, we have them in those roles, but we have them in a lot of other roles as well. If you think about the civilian world, the general community, there are gays and lesbians in every occupation yep. imaginable, but there are probably some areas where we are overrepresented, let us say, areas like in medical, in the media. In hospitality, some would argue the Catholic Church as well. And I'd say that's probably fairly similar in the military as well.
Okay, could I just ask leading Seaman Malcolm about that as well? Do you know many gay and lesbian people in the Defence
Yes,
Force?
I do. Yes, quite a few. Absolutely. And as the Major just said, it does probably... there seems to be more people in different categories or trades or from my experience, certainly working in hospitality trades within
okay.
the...
So you don't have any gay guys just being grunts? Sorry, I've just been watching too many American movies, I guess.
Oh, you certainly do. I know.
Yeah, there you go.
So the Navy has been perhaps unfairly targeted as being a harbinger of homosexualities. It's probably a bit exaggerated, would you say, Troy?
I don't know. I have met a lot of people in the Navy who are gay and...
Major Hadfield?
I think the village people were onto something.
Okay, so we've got the current situation that it's completely okay for gay and lesbian people to be openly gay and go in the army and in the Defence Force. That's across the board. That's how it is legally, is it right? What's it like actually? Because the laws might say, and you know, all the policies say, yes, it's fine for homosexuals, but is it really? Now, you would think... For everything we've seen in popular culture since the 1930s, that it would be very difficult for homosexuals, men particularly, not so bad for lesbians, but it looks as though it would be impossible for men. Now, what's it like really? Perhaps Major Hadfield, you can tell us first. How is it accepted by the rest of the Defence Force?
Look, I'll draw you an analogy here, Adam.
Okay.
After I joined the military, which was in 1996. My second posting, I was actually posted down to Tasmania, and it was just after the laws had changed down there.
Right.
My attempts to be a martyr have been thwarted at every turn, both by the military and by Tasmanian law. I went down there, and I did see in Tasmania that you can change the law, but it takes a while to change the culture.
Right.
And I would say the same's probably applied in the military, but you know, that was what, 17 years ago.
Yeah, and so you're right, it does take, laws don't change attitudes immediately, but they do eventually.
Yes, yes, they certainly do. And I guess the more people who are openly gay and lesbian in the military, the faster that process, I guess, happens.
Okay. Because I have heard other people being interviewed who are gay in the Army, which in the Defence Force, sorry, I keep saying Army and I mean the Defence Force, I have heard it on other radio stations, and I was really quite amazed. They're saying that they don't have any problems and it's fine and they're completely open with the other people they serve with. And I thought, that doesn't sound right to me.
Well, no, you're right, because the image is that particularly the Army is a very sort of masculine kind of organisation, and other people who find gays in their midst might feel threatened by it.
Let's ask leading seaman Malcolm about this particular topic. Do any of the other people that you work with, do you think there's any discomfort?
No, look, I can't certainly comment on the Army side of things, but certainly on the Air Force and the Navy. No, look, none whatsoever. I would never...
All right, Major Hadfield, have there been any instances that you can perhaps allude to for us where you've had been called in to deal with episodes of homophobia?
Look, I certainly can't think of any. And look, I'll use another analogy here. People have stereotypes about the gay community.
Yeah.
And if they're not familiar with gays, they'll think that we're all the same. Or if they know one gay person, they think they know all gay people.
Okay.
You know, and it's not always helpful to label us all with the same brush. Yeah. You know, in the same sort of way, perhaps, that, you know, Ivan perceives all Japanese to be the same. You know, there are stereotypes about soldiers as well. And they think that we're all the same. We're not. We all have different opinions and attitudes to a raft of issues. And it's not the Army that has imposed these attitudes on us. It's the attitudes that we bring to the services already. So I would believe that there would be some soldiers in the military that are not that comfortable with, you know, serving with other gay men.
But they don't make an issue out of it.
They don't make an issue. Well, if they did make an issue, the Army wouldn't tolerate that. We have, you know, very extensive equity and diversity principles that we apply, whether it's based on gender, based on sexuality, or based on race.
Major Hadfield, in your personal experiences, have you come across situations where you've had difficulty with sexuality and other people in the Defence Force?
If anyone's ever had a concern with my sexuality, they've never addressed it to my face.
Right. What about you, leading seaman Malcolm?
No, but speaking back from years ago, back in the mid-80s and that sort of thing, it was quite prevalent then. I guess a few people I know got quite a lot of flack over it, but, like, times have changed now, and I guess...
This is really great having you in here, leading seaman Malcolm, because you came out... And you've been in the armed forces, and you came out during that process, so you would have seen quite an evolution.
Oh God,
of attitude.
My word, yeah. I remember, and I was just talking to Vince yesterday about it. And my first experience was, I was in Castlereagh Street in Sydney, taking an oath at 17 to serve in the Air Force, and I remember I can't remember his rank. This officer's up the front there, and he said, "Now, I just want to say something. If any of you guys feel that you're that way, you're free to go now." Well, I didn't really understand what that way was, and then we're driving down to South Australia, and I remember once again they commented, "If anyone feels they are that way, it's probably best to leave now." It's not until later on in life you sort of understand what it was all about. My word.
In the second half hour of our show, we've got Major Hadfield on until 12:30. Troy, I might discuss some of that with
you
because it's quite interesting.
Yes.
Major Hadfield, I wanted to ask you about the soldiers who did come out being gay prior to 1992 and what's happened to those that got this dishonourable discharge. We heard from Lee Visser in the first hour of our show how he was gay and he went to Vietnam, and he wasn't terrified, but he was somewhat apprehensive and anxious should his sexuality be discovered that he may get a dishonourable discharge. And he said that he knew several people who got these dishonourable discharges. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
All right, for a start, let's I'm happy if you want to call me Damien.
Oh, no, I like being formal. It makes it sound as though I know what I'm doing.
Oh, okay. Maybe we could recruit you. You sound like you're halfway. look, I can really comment mostly on my own experience.
Okay.
But I'll certainly say that, you know, when I did make the decision to join the army, even though it was just after the laws had changed, that was still in my mind. The idea of, you know, well, how will I be treated? Probably a lot of that went away when I went into the recruiting centre, and the only other person that was joining up for my my particular trade, we got chatting and ended up going out for 5 years. But
right.
but
because I know there were a lot of men who went through this dishonourable discharge thing, and now that everything's different and it's all quite acceptable, where are they now, and is there any likelihood anybody might say sorry to them? Or do they have any regress for any compensation? It's just an interesting issue.
Yeah, it is, and look, I really don't know the answer to that. I haven't heard of anything along that lines, but who knows, down the track, that might be something that is discussed. I'm really not sure.
Because I'm big on this apology thing. You know what I mean? And like, I'd like my high school, two of the high schools that I went to apologise to me for encouraging the students to beat me because they thought I was gay, because it would cure me from being gay. Okay, I went through a significant trauma in high school, and I'd like some redress. And I think probably the soldiers that suffered a dishonourable discharge because they were gay, possibly it'd be nice if somebody said, look, we're sorry, but at the time, that was the way things, but we're just sorry now. What do you think, leading seaman Malcolm?
Yeah, look, I've known quite a few people, good people with pretty good skills and trade sets, you know, trades and professions behind them. That Defence spent a lot of money in training those guys, and yeah, look, I've seen a couple of people come back and have rank come back with rank and that sort of thing.
Really?
So, yeah, absolutely. I saw one guy in particular that I bumped into about 5 years ago who I knew that, and he was an education officer, like a teacher, mm-hmm. with a commission rank, and look, he went through a pretty bad time as well.
So he got a dishonourable discharge?
No, it wasn't a dishonourable discharge. It was he was decided to leave, I think, because of the pressures upon okay. him. So, and then, as I said, I bumped into him again, and he's back in the system. Yeah.
Major Hadfield, it sounds as though the Army has gone through somewhat of a social renaissance since 1992 in its acceptance of gay and lesbian people. Do they go out of their way, or do they make any effort to recruit gay and lesbian people?
Not that I know of, but I would actually say that the gay and lesbian community, in some respects, has been quite a fertile recruiting ground for the military. They'll give you snappy uniforms and butch boots and sensible haircuts. But also, I think a number of people who are attracted to the military are attracted because their current circumstances are not that great. You know, the Army will feed you and clothe you and give you a trade and sponsor your education. And so for someone who maybe like in your instance, who's had a hard time at school, perhaps their family, if they've been out to their family, haven't taken it that well, have sometimes been drawn to the military as a chance to have a new life.
Okay. Can I just move on to another topic now? I just wanted to, in your particular expertise, Major Hadfield, as an army psychologist, a couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Dr. Ivan Holmes, who fought in New Guinea, and he went through quite a horrendous time, and some of the really awful stuff he experienced, he didn't recount on radio. I asked him to be careful, because some of it was particularly violent. People who serve in the army now, and are deployed overseas. And we saw a Four Corners show a couple of weeks ago with some of the soldiers who have been in Iraq and Afghanistan going through almost horrendous situations. But the Army really does seem now to have really significant support mechanisms for people who go through trauma of deployment. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, look, we've come a long way. Just as society's come a long way in how it deals with responses to trauma and this sort of stuff, the Defence Mental Health Strategy is in place to offer support through psychologists, social workers, chaplains, We also have the medical system as well to make sure that people aren't slipping through the cracks and coming back like Ivan's generation did, and just being sort of, you know, let loose back into society without a sense of support, I guess. And you know, we see that is quite important. You know, the stuff that Ivan and his generation did for our country needs to be remembered, and that's why Anzac Day is very important, and that is why,
yes,
I'm glad that your show is acknowledging this. And I don't know how many times Ivan said, I just listened to his podcast before I came on, how many times he spoke with such pride about how we stopped the Japs.
Yes.
In his words. And, you know, we do owe Ivan and his generation a huge debt
of gratitude.
Gratitude.
Putting their lives on the line to defend our country and protect our way of life. Look, I have the absolute highest of high respects for anybody who works in the Defence Force and anybody who puts their lives on the line to defend Australia and our way of life. They are the unsung heroes. And what really upsets me personally is when you see them, you know, you see things the way the people from Vietnam, for example,
yes,
when they came back to Australia, that was probably one of the biggest, most shameful things in Australian history, where they were sneaked in the back door.
I certainly agree with that, Adam. But I'd also say that support that we provide extends to a lot of the other things that the military are involved in that isn't a conflict situation. I was involved with Banda Aceh after the tsunami,
okay,
for example, where we went over and our engineers and our medical people, you know, helped the people on the ground. The recent bushfires, and I know that, you know, tragedy certainly touched Ivan in that respect, as well as going to war. You know, I listened with interest when, I'm not sure if it was Marysville or maybe Kinglake, when they were opened up again,
yes,
to the field to go back. You know, the reporters were saying, oh, well, the army's been through and cleared out the dead bodies now so that the locals can go back.
Yes,
you know,
and
so,
of course...
So our soldiers, you know, I'm always amazed at their resilience.
Yes, I mean, that's such a traumatic experience in itself, having to go and clean out the remains of human bodies. So, well, the army really serves us so well. Major Hadfield, it's probably coming to the end when we have to let you go. Thank you so much for your contribution on Allegro Non Troppo. And I would just like to, we're going to continue locally with leading seaman Malcolm. I'd also just like to say thank you to Squadron Leader Vince Chong, who's arranged all of this through the DEFGLIS, which is the Defence Force Gay and Lesbian Support Service. Is that, have I got that right?
Pretty close, Information Service. But yeah, look, you know, and this is, I guess, an example of how far we have come, that we now have our own support network, and you know, we organise marches in the Mardi Gras, and we organise awareness throughout all of defence and support and that sort of stuff. And it is, I guess, another example of how we are progressing in this regard.
Okay.
But hey, Adam, thanks. Look, you know, it's been 15 years since I was on Joy Melbourne, so it's good to be back.
Just before you go, do you have a message for the community, the people who are thinking about that maybe they want to be in the Defence Force?
Yeah, Adam, look, I've certainly met a lot of people in the recent years who, you know, when they found out I was in the Army, have gone, oh, gee, look, I've thought about that, but I'm really not sure. And I guess there are a lot of misconceptions there about how gays and lesbians do get treated in the military. And certainly I would say my experience, and those are the people that I know these days, is very different to some of the stories that we may have heard 15 or 20 years ago. So I'd encourage anyone to have a look at the military, you know, either through general entry, through a trade, or through the Defence Force Academy, and for where you get your degree paid for, basically. And, you know, that's one way that people who maybe are struggling to get a degree, put themselves through uni, can go and do that.
And as you said, you get a snappy uniform, good haircut, and a really good set of boots.
Exactly. And look, you know, be it hospitality, medicine, in the media, in the helping professions like I am, you know, there's plenty of avenues, and there's lots of other gay men and lesbians serving our country, so you're not going to be the only one, trust me.
Damien Hadfield, that is fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us on Allegro, and please pass on our sincere thanks to Squadron Leader Chong.
No worries. Thanks,
okay,
a lot, Adam.
Thank you. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network with Adam and Peter.
Allegro Non Troppo is produced at radio station 3JOY and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
Leading up to Anzac Day, we've been doing an ARC theme for 3 weeks on Allegro Non Troppo, looking at the armed forces, and we're looking at various aspects. And today, we're talking to Australian Defence Force personnel about their experiences as homosexuals in the armed forces. But we just thought, as a little bit of a contrast, we might have a look at what it's been like historically in some of the armed services in other countries. We'll have a look at one that when I did some research on the internet this week. In 1934, the Nazis shot dead their own leader, Ernst Röhm, who was openly gay. A special criminal police force was created to fight homosexuality, and in 1943, Himmler issued a secret order to execute all SS and police found to be gay or even guilty of homosexual intent. From 1935 onwards, the slightest sign of homosexual tendencies was punished. Waves of arrests and trials followed between 1936 and 1939. 42,919 men were sentenced. Between 1941 and 1944, there were 12,000 indictments, and the military police convicted 7,000 homosexual soldiers. In total, the number of males convicted of homosexuality was estimated to be 60,000.
As early as 1933, German homosexuals had been offered the alternatives of castration or being sent to a concentration camp. In the camps, they were identified by pink triangles and condemned to hard labour. The policy was to separate and try to re-educate them, and if this failed, to kill them. In attempts to cure them of their disease, many homosexuals were subjected to horrible pseudo-medical experiments, including chemical injections and operations. It's been estimated that the death rate of homosexuals in the camps was as high as 60%. Homosexual survivors were not compensated after the war, as their behaviour was still largely regarded by German society as perverted and illegal, and their suffering therefore justified.
That's quite horrendous when you think what the German soldiers, gay German soldiers, went through under Hitler's regime. Then when they were liberated, those few that survived from the camps, the society said, well, we don't have to say sorry to you because you got what you deserved.
Well, I mean, that attitude, though, wasn't just from Germany. I mean, all over Europe, or in England and those kinds of countries, the attitude towards homosexuals was not a positive one.
I wonder what it's like now in Germany. It'd be interesting to find out, wouldn't it?
Well, you've been fairly recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, but for the soldiers, for soldiers across the world. The whole world seems to be moving to a more enlightened acceptance and inclusion of gay and lesbian people, yet there are still sections of society where it's still hideously taboo. They were saying in this little article that we just read out, Peter, that they were using chemical injections and other therapies to cure people of homosexuality. Mm. That still happens today.
Yeah.
Some of these ex-gay ministry things and stuff like that are really quite hideous.
You can be cured, as though it's a disease.
Indeed. Our special guest on Allegro today is leading seaman Troy Malcolm. Troy, I'm not going to say leading seaman anymore.
Mouthful.
We're talking here about war soldiers and all of that. Have you ever seen any action?
No, I've never been in a conflict or anything like that, no.
Would you go?
Well, it's a part of the deal. I'm a reserve, serving the reserve, and it is part of the deal that there may be a time, yes.
That you would have to fight.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's a part of it, knowing that. That's in the back of your mind. But we train very, very well for that, to cover...
Have you been trained to kill?
I can shoot a rifle, yes. I'm not a very good shot, though, but... If I needed to, I'd be able to defend myself, and I'm taught to defend myself and in my workplace by using a rifle, which is an assault rifle. Yeah.
Do you know anybody who's killed anybody?
Personally, no, I don't know.
I would be very interested to find out what it was like.
Yeah.
One of the future shows, perhaps you might be able to help us resource, or Major Vince Chong might be able to get us somebody who's actually shot somebody. I'd love to find out what it's like.
Yeah.
I think if we were living in America, it wouldn't be that difficult. Peter was reading the other day, in Australia we have 65 people have been killed in Australia in the last year by guns,
yeah.
Murdered in guns. In the US, 11,000. People have been, but it's incredible, isn't it?
Absolutely.
When they train you in the army,
the navy, yeah.
In the defence force, let's say, they don't train you with the likelihood that you're going to go to war, do they?
Oh, absolutely. Especially, oh, my word. Especially, yes, in the navy, we train for firefighting, which is a big, certainly a big thing on the ships, and with my role, my trade is a steward. However, I have a secondary role, which is equally important as a ship's medical and emergency team personnel. So it's a first aid and medical right at the point where it's happening. So, yeah, it is for real. It absolutely.
Major Hadfield pointed out a couple of interesting things that I hadn't considered. Is it's not just in the defence of the country or aiding other countries which have a particular campaigns or war theatres that they're operating, but the army actually does a lot of other things. They were in Aceh after the tsunami.
For sure, yeah.
And that must have been an absolutely incredible experience and quite horrifying. And they were in the Victorian bushfires cleaning out the bodies from the town. So sure. The army does a lot more like that. If you had to shoot somebody, I'm going on about this because it's...
I'd probably miss, but go on.
What about bayoneting?
We just don't have that. We don't bayonet. I haven't seen a bayonet on a rifle for many, many years now.
So I think they did away with horses a while ago too, aren't they?
As my great-grandfather used to tell, regaled me of stories when he was fighting in North Africa, that they ran out of bullets and they only had, and so did the enemy, and they were in this particular location, and the hand-to-hand fighting that went for days was bayonet charges.
For sure.
So they'd come charging over one particular thing and jump in their trenches and then have this big bayonet fight, and then they'd retreat, they'd clean up the bodies, and then in the middle of the night they'd sneak over to where the enemy was and they'd jump in their trenches and try and bayonet them. And I mean, it sounds quite comical, but it's absolutely
horrendous.
It doesn't
sound comical to me at all.
And he was telling me another time, he went from North Africa, and I think he was in France, and they used mustard gas.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And warfare now is so sanitised. How much technology have you learned to operate?
Huge amount.
Yeah, well, these days, I guess, from a ship, a missile or rocket's launched and travels... You know, hundreds of kilometres away to its target, so it's a little bit different. I guess with the army, with infantry, it's more, you know, face to face.
Okay, might leave that topic for a while because I could talk all day about the horrors of war and what I imagine them to be, but the horrors of sexuality in the Defence Force are probably far more interesting. Is the I wanted to talk about the RSL.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, and just
I'm not a member personally. No.
Okay, because I remember people like Bruce Ruxton years ago. Had made a lot of derogatory comments about homosexuals, and I got this attitude that the RSL was probably one of the bastions for homophobia. I wonder if it still is.
Look, I can't comment because I'm not a member of it. I've never really been... the RSL does lots and lots of good things for returned servicemen, and certainly... But I really can't comment it. Doesn't... And Mr. Ruxton, I've only really read and seen what I've seen in the media and that, and he was a colourful gentleman. He had lots to say, and it was quite interesting.
Sure, you're very, very good at this, aren't you?
A diplomat, indeed.
Now, so if gay and lesbian people can be in the armed services in whatever they want to be, what happens? The rank and file officers, they don't give you a hard time, they don't make jokes.
No, look,
Name-calling?
No, throughout my service career, and I got out for a while, and, you know, I got out of the Air Force in 94 and had quite a long break and pursued, you know, civilian employment. And you're judged on your ability to be able to do the job.
Okay.
As a professional. You're a professional first, and
With regard to, say, two men or two women form a relationship in the Air Force or whatever.
In the same unit or the same ship or whatever.
What's the policy there with regard to that?
Look, I'm not really at this. Policy's changed from my own experience. I know from back in Air Force days, if a married couple were I don't think they didn't have them serving in the same squadron or unit. I think they used to they'd post them in the same locality, but obviously in different units and that sort of thing. Navy, look, I have heard of couples serving on the same ship, and that's certainly got to be
you have to go through the chain of command and certainly let you know, the management on board that ship or unit know what's going on there. Yeah.
So if you have would they be able to say spend nights together?
No, or? Definitely not. That's no, because at sea you have your males separated to females for obvious reasons.
Okay, so the fantasy we see in a lot of the fictional things on videos of sailors having orgies doesn't exist.
Well, imagine
absolutely not.
Imagine
not
cohabiting in a hammock might be a bit difficult.
You have to look at it. Look, you got I guess the size of this room. You've got probably around about 12 sailors living in that mess deck, it's yeah, so it is quite...
Troy, in other areas of our culture, for example, like in sport, and I'm thinking particularly AFL, one of the things we hear frequently is that one of the reasons they don't encourage or want homosexual men involved in this sport is because the other players would feel very uneasy that people were trying to crack onto them or pervert them in the showers. Does anything like that go through the Navy or the Defence Force?
There's those movies again.
Yeah.
A lot of on bases and that sort of thing, a lot of our accommodation is shared between male and female. So the facilities are set up where for privacy and and even on the ship for that matter, it's all segregated as well. There's you have your own private showers and that sort of thing. That's not. One big shower. It's certainly nothing like that, no.
I think I've been watching too much adult entertainment.
I think you have there.
But it's a bit like one of those, the Defence Force, it's because it's cloistered away and it's not sort of open to, we can't see a lot of it. It's our popular culture and we get these urban myths about happens.
And certainly when you're at sea or you're deployed somewhere, you're there for a reason. You're there to fill a position on board the ship or a position in the unit and that's your role and look, you really don't have much time. The time you do have is just a bit of downtime to rest and that sort of thing, so no.
When you first came out and you realised you were gay and some of the people that you were with in the army, did you come out to them?
Look, no, I didn't. I went and sort of explored my sexuality myself. I remember I was in the Air Force and I was based in Wagga out in the Riverina and I heard that there was this little wine bar. It was nothing. It was called the Number 96. And I remember, and I had heard that that was a gay friendly. So I went and had a look at the Number 96, and there was no one there. When I came out, look, I just came out to myself. I think that was the most important thing at that time. I wasn't too worried about, and obviously. To my mother and my brother and that sort of thing, that was very important to be open with them. But and what led on professionally within in defence at that time? I got to the stage where I was confident. I felt that I was confident within my role, and my supervisors, my flight sergeants and warrant officers, and the officers running supply officers and that sort of thing. Look, they respect you for your profession. If you can do the job and do it well, that sort of didn't come into it. Look, they suspect it anyhow, so.
Okay. But none of them, before 1992, I'm quite interested, so nobody sort of dragged you off to one side and said, look, we think you're a poofter and you don't belong here. That didn't happen?
No, but in saying that, there was a lot of poofter jokes getting around and I felt, you know yourself if it's aimed at you, and they weren't sort of aimed at me, and I think I sort of kept my head down for a little while.
Yeah.
And I think it paid too.
To dodge the bullets.
After 1992 and in the recent times now, so it's quite okay and open. Do you know many gay and lesbian people in the army?
In defence itself, I know lots. Lots of my friends are friends in the Air Force and certainly friends in the Navy. And absolutely. There's for sure. There's heaps. And you couldn't sit down and I'd be going through it all day if I had to think of it.
Okay.
Yeah. There's heaps.
Does it come up very often? Do you have to say, oh, I'm gay, or does that happen, or do you have to disclose it to people?
But I think in conversation, you know, if you're a full-time serving member and you're applying for a married quarter and you know, people say, oh, well, they expect that they obviously you are with a partner or a wife or something. So, I think...
No sideways glances or raised eyebrows or anything?
I just don't think people do it these days, especially in inter de facto relationships are recognised throughout in defence now for defence.
Since 2005.
So what would happen there is if, for example, I did full-time service and I was required to go somewhere or deploy somewhere, I'd go away having the full support of defence, supporting my partner, and I'd get reunion leave and everything that was afforded to a heterosexual couple. So, yeah.
Do you have a partner?
Fantastic. Yes, I do, yeah. Right. Partner of 8 years, and that's Paul, and I'm sure he's listening today. He's at work today, so.
Okay, he's not in the Defence Force.
No, he did work for Department of Defence for a little while as a defence civilian, but, managing a successful family business now, so.
Okay. We're looking a little bit towards the future, so it's quite okay for gay and lesbian people to serve in the armed forces in Australia. It's not so open in other countries, particularly the US seem to be going through some sort of terrible time with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But we're quite lucky in Australia.
We are, absolutely. We really, really are. When you just read articles that, this serving silence and don't ask, don't tell, I think that's just... They've got such a long way to go, and I really wish those guys the best. You know,
do you like being in the army, in the Defence Force?
I do. I've now been in for quite some time. Look, it's a good reward. It takes, as I said, I'm a reserve now, so I work for a civilian company. You know, and it takes me out of that back into defence. And look, you'd really do learn a lot of good skill sets, good decision making. I do. I like it for that reason. Yeah.
What's the discipline like?
It's not what you'd, I guess you'd perceive it to be. It's you're operating around some pretty dangerous gear. Let's face it, defence. It's all about, things blowing up or things that can stop an enemy. So there is some really, really nasty pieces of hardware that we do have in our arsenal. But and the discipline's there for that reason, because you have to maintain discipline for a safe working...
Can I ask you your personal opinions about Australia's defence? Now, this is a bit more of a general thing, because it seems as though our defence budget's up and down. But defence forces go, we really, in Australia, we have 25,000 serving people in the Australian Defence Force.
We've got that many, I do.
Centrelink has 27,000 employees.
Yeah, look... That's a policy. That's a government policy, and I can't really. We're a very, very well equipped defence force, a very high tech defence force, and because the nature of the role and demands that you just can't. I know what you're sort of alluding to. They put people that are on benefits into defence, and look, that's just
is that we don't have a very big defence force,
but we fight Australia fights on technology, not manpower. We do have a technology is extremely high in the Australian Defence Force. Yeah,
because we've got our own submarines that we make here, our Collins class submarines,
and that was a feat of itself, and that really shows how good Australian technology and industry is to be able to produce a weapon of that type. Yeah,
I think the thing that, like, we don't have many aircraft carriers, and we don't have brilliant planes. I think we need a new set of aeroplanes, don't we?
Well, they're coming. It's been announced.
Is it the
F-35 Raptor, which is
the American one?
Yes, that's right. So,
okay, can I have a little bit of a self-indulgent thing here? You know what I love? I don't see them anymore. Was the Harrier jump jets?
Oh, okay.
Launched off the side of
the ski jump on the carrot. Yeah, that's right.
Because the Harrier jump jets were lowered by like a crane thing over the side of the ship, and they had VTOL engines, which is vertical takeoff and landing. Mm-hmm. So they'd hoist these things rather like lifeboats over the side of the boat, then fire up the engines, and then drop them off the hook, and they used to fly. They were great.
Yeah.
So expensive to run. And I just trying to remember, was it one of the Australian aircraft carriers was in rough seas and several planes fell off the end?
I'm not sure. I'm sure that has happened to it with US carriers that are quite big. So I've
because they haven't been tied up or whatever they do to hold them on the deck, and suddenly rough seas came out of nowhere.
It's
and
like a catapult thing that they hook onto, isn't it? Like a great big elastic band. Mm.
Have you been on one of those really fast jets?
I was actually fortunate enough to have a backseat ride of an F-18, so prior to leaving my posting in Katherine in the Northern Territory, so I did have an experience in it.
One of those planes that fly over during the Grand Prix.
Yeah, that's an F-18.
I was watching that, and it was flying around, and then it went up vertically and just disappeared.
Yeah,
just
he would have went up to around about 40,000, 37,000 feet. When you look at how long it takes an airliner to reach 37,000, it takes about a good 20, at least 20 minutes to even get anywhere near that. And he was doing that within less than a minute. So,
The power in those is amazing. Yeah,
can I tell you what the outcome, the consequence of those is? My brother, when he was in the Air Cadets, and he went into the Air Force for a while, they said to him, empty your bladder. Beforehand, he said, what? You know, don't be ridiculous. I don't need to go. He said, you better empty your bladder.
Yeah.
He didn't. Yeah. And the G-force, and when he came out, the pressure had emptied his bladder for him.
Yeah, well, I remember when I went for that backseat ride. Look, it was fantastic. I don't think nothing would ever equal that. But I remember it was like sitting in the back seat. It's a dual seat F-18, and I was actually sitting in the back and in the rear seat. And it was like nursing a Kelvinator fridge. You couldn't move. You're actually a part of the plane. You're really pressed into it. I couldn't even move my jaw. And that's what he did. He just took off and then just went vertical and...
Wow, what an experience.
Yeah, so it was a pretty good ride, yeah.
Did you feel it right in the pit of your stomach?
I think I might have blacked out for a couple of seconds because I remember he rolled it over onto its back, and the only reason I knew we were upside down is because I could see dust on the canopy on the...
And then I opened
my eyes and I just looked out and it was and looked down the bottom and it was just the whole... And of course, in the Northern Territory, it was just all the red land. Yeah.
Troy Malcolm, let me tell you, if I was in that situation, I would have to be wearing nappies. Just imagine if they rolled it upside down. Yeah. I've been in a plane, in a commercial airliner, that dropped 1,000 feet in like 2 seconds once.
Yeah, so you would have certainly...
So I've been in the anti-gravity situation once. That was terrifying. So being in one of those planes. Mm. This has been a really interesting conversation today. Mm. Thank you for sharing your stories of what it's like in the Defence Force. What are you going to do in the future?
I'm looking at transitioning back to the Air Force. That's just for personal reasons, professional reasons with my civilian employment. I'm just not getting the time now to look. The Navy demands, especially as a reserve, to keep going through the ranks, and that sort of thing demands a little bit more training than what I can sort of give at this stage. So I'm looking at returning back to the Air Force in previous rank. And you must like it, do you? Look, yeah, I do. I really do. And there's some really good benefits. If anyone's ever considering a job with reserve, it's certainly fantastic. Yeah, there's the, you know, we're entitled now to the Defence Home Ownership Scheme, which
so there's a lot of benefits.
And it's tax free money, and you'd certainly learn some really good trade skills. So I'd recommend that to anyone who was thinking, even if they didn't want to do full time, but looking at a part time career.
And it's coming up to Anzac Day. Does this mean anything special for you, Troy Malcolm?
I guess so. Being a Defence Force person. I haven't, as I said, never been to a war or anything or any sort of conflict and that. But yeah, no, it does mean a lot. Major Hatfield's saying, it's certainly those guys, without those guys, I don't think we'd be here today. So yeah, for sure. Yeah,
and I'd like to take this opportunity on behalf of Allegro Non Troppo and indeed the gay and lesbian community in general to thank all of the people in all of the Defence Forces across all generations. Thank you for your contribution. Thank you for keeping us safe. We appreciate it. We'll be back next week with another Allegro Non Troppo, everyone. Bye.
Bye.